right at the beginning of paper 8, which is old single column, page 90. All right, so as we do this preface and then the first section, he's got a parallel structure in both of these that you'll notice. Both of them, he really starts out in a very, kind of how low you still are relative to evolutionary religion in a story about the beginning of things, he tries to drop down and meet you there. So he tells of, you know, especially in some passages, quite anthropomorphic story to try to kind of meet you there. But notice how he, at the very least, you'll notice how he ends both the section 0 and section 1 with a but, you know, and trying to challenge you to not just, you know, think of things in such a simple individuality viewpoint, and especially anthropomorphic way. But he's really wanting you to have an on-ramp. So he's kind of, he's almost pushing it to the level of, of childish, or at least childlike, you know, in the way he approaches it. So, you know, just very purposely trying to start you off gently, try to get you going in a bigger picture. I won't necessarily comment on that again. Just notice that that's in play. And then we'll see the other things that he's doing, you know, besides that sort of introductory engagement of you as a reader. All right.
Paper 8, The Infinite Spirit. Back in eternity, when the Universal Father's first infinite and absolute thought finds in the Eternal Son such a perfect and adequate word for its divine expression, there ensues the supreme desire of both the thought God and the word God for a universal and infinite agent of mutual expression and combined action. In the dawn of eternity, both the Father and the Son become infinitely cognizant of their mutual interdependence, their eternal and absolute oneness, and therefore do they enter into an infinite and everlasting covenant of divine partnership. This never-ending compact is made for the execution of their united concepts throughout all the circle of eternity. And ever since this eternity event, the Father and the Son continue in this divine union. We are now face to face with the eternity origin of the Infinite Spirit, the third person of Deity. The very instant that God the Father and God the Son conjointly conceive an identical and infinite action, the execution of an absolute thought plan, that very moment the Infinite Spirit springs full-fledgedly into existence. In thus reciting the order of the origin of the deities, I do so merely to enable you to think of their relationship. In reality, they are all three existent from eternity. They are existential. They are without beginning or ending of days. They are coordinate, supreme, ultimate, absolute, and infinite. They are and always have been and ever shall be. And they are three distinctly individualized but eternally associated persons, God the Father, God the Son, and God the Spirit.
So beautiful. Okay. So you see that basic pattern I was talking about. But notice his choice of designations. So he starts out very much exactly like I said. Notice in the first paragraph, it's the Universal Father and the Eternal Son. That's definitely individuality viewpoint names. But right away, second paragraph, it's the Father and the Son. See, twice. So he's using, you know, the name for the type of deity. And then you go to the third paragraph. Okay, now he's bringing in the third individuality name, the infinite spirit, but the Father and the Son, he's taking to the next notch. Now it's God the Father and God the Son. You know, so he's flipping you around a unity viewpoint and then personalizing the designations from that unity viewpoint. And then you go to the last paragraph, and now he's got all three: God the Father, God the Son, and God the Spirit. See, so just in the way he's choosing the designations, he's evolving it across those four paragraphs. Especially to, by the time he gets to that fourth paragraph, which you can see is set off by a large paragraph break, he's very much, you know, if you're ready to notice it, encouraging you to let go of such a simplistic, you know, very temporal sort of an individuality viewpoint, and see if you can think about it from the top down, where there's one God with three facets in this case, you know, God the Father, God the Son, God the Spirit. And notice what else of a unity viewpoint nature is there. Coordinate. That list there? Okay, so they are coordinate. In other words, you know, think about the facets of deity from the unity viewpoint that you could run. You could have the Mother, the Supreme, the Ultimate, the Absolute, and the Infinite. In that little sequence there in that last paragraph. See, so the whole thing is encouraging you, if you're ready to notice that, to allow you, you know, like the resonance that Pam was commenting on after we finished reading it, you know, you feel the beauty of it. You feel the beauty of how he's taking kind of that basic way of describing things that humans kind of have, but, you know, definitely amping it up. But at the same time, you know, encouraging you to not stop there, to let that just be a beginning to your thinking about the three persons of the Trinity. Okay, so now he kind of does it again. Only takes it up a notch.
Oh, wait a minute.
Okay, yeah. Oh, yeah, and there's a question here, too.
Okay.
Yeah.
I cannot believe them. They have the same identical thought at the same time, and then it creates another being.
Right, so that's the source fact at the top of everything. So what are you supposed to be moving toward? You're supposed to be moving towards something that's not just being on the same spiritual page at the same time, kindred spirits. You're supposed to be moving towards something like this, where you have the same thought, where you're kindred minds, where you establish the kindred spirit fact as a foundation, not as something you're reaching up to occasionally, but you do a chin up on it, put it underneath you and stand on it, and now do kindred mind on top of that. You know, and eventually when you get to paradise as a finaliter, you start to do this. You and another finaliter, you a native paradise citizen, will have such a perfectly synchronized, simultaneous thought, and it literally gives rise instantly to a being.
That's the Trinity
origin. Yeah, creature trinitized sons. Okay. All right. So, but you don't complete that kindred mind state until you get all the way to paradise. You know, until you have that fullness of mother-like nature. You know that you can be a trinitizer like that. Yeah, and give rise to a creature trinitized son. Okay.
Well, I couldn't help but notice in this list they seem to be in an ascending order. Is that necessarily the truth of it, or are they all existent at the same?
Well, when you're talking about an infinite being, you know, they have all those things in them.
Okay.
You know, I mean, the reason that there can be a finite is because the finite is contained within the infinite. Now, the infinite is not contained within the finite. But the finite is contained within the infinite. The absolute is contained within the infinite. The co-absolute is contained within the infinite, and you know, et cetera. Okay, right. It's all within the infinite. Yeah. So, yeah. So they're just reminding you that, you know, you have all that bottled up together in those three infinite beings, and then they have different ways of letting some of that hierarchy out and downstepping from them. You know, there can be a hierarchy because they have the whole hierarchy embodied within them, so they can express it as a ladder downwards to you, you know, or a staircase downwards to you. Okay, so let's try it again.
The God of Action. In the eternity of the past, upon the personalization of the Infinite Spirit, the Divine Personality cycle becomes perfect and complete. The God of Action is existent, and the vast stage of space is set for the stupendous drama of creation, the universal adventure, the divine panorama of the eternal ages. The first act of the Infinite Spirit is the inspection and recognition of His divine parents, the Father, Father, and the Mother, Son. He, the Spirit, unqualifiedly identifies both of them. He is fully cognizant of their separate personalities and infinite attributes, as well as of their combined nature and united function. Next, voluntarily, with transcendent willingness and inspiring spontaneity, the third person of deity, notwithstanding his equality with the first and second persons, pledges eternal loyalty to God the Father and acknowledges everlasting dependence upon God the Son.
Okay, so see now that one, you can see, you know, you have that very basic, you know, quite anthropomorphic feeling paragraph in many ways, or, you know, a story in many ways. Certainly individuality viewpoint. And, you know, in that mode, you would go, okay, so I see that they've got the Father and the Son, and they're saying, you know, think of it kind of like parents. And so one's kind of like the Father and one's kind of like the Mother. And so that's why they said Father, Father, and Mother, Son. Okay, so, you know, as an initial reader, you know, you've got something there that you can make something of and start building on. But we all know it's not just for story's sake. You know, that facet of deity called the Son literally, you know, does have mother deity bonded to it. We just read about it, you know, when we were talking in the previous paper when we were talking about the Son. You know, and it becomes the Mother Son. Mother deity is attached to the core of Son type deity. It becomes Mother Son type deity, you know, that's now personalized as the eternal Mother Son. Okay. And that Father Father. Okay, so in the same parallel, if it's the experiential-like deity that's being tacked onto the existential foundation, but remember how it works for the Father. You know, you keep going up. When you get to the infinite upholder, you go from the finite upholder to the absolute upholder to the absolute upholder, you go up to the infinite upholder, that's the point at which the Mother becomes the Father. That's the point at really which the distinction breaks down at the infinite level. And so at the infinite level, the Mother, quote unquote, is the Father. So now it's the Father added to the Father. You know, or, you know, another way, it's just invoking, you know, if what you're thinking of being tacked on to a root, you know, is that infinite upholder, you know, down at the core, you know, that's the first source and center universal Father thing. You know, so the Father, Father, see, is really invoking the whole spectrum of the Father, the whole circuit, even if you will, of the Father. Okay. Yeah?
Mm-hmm. Are these three the infinity?
No. That's a separate story. We'll get to that in the in the seminar.
Chris, did you get to the point where that's how it's explained to us and that really it just all happened at...
Right, well, you know, he's going to say that again at the end of this section, just like he did at the end of the first one, I said. You know, but, you know, that's always in play. But we understand that. That's fine. You know, we can go with that. He's telling an individuality viewpoint story, and let's draw as much as we can from it. Now, you know, it's not like the individuality viewpoint is invalid. You know, it's just not the whole story. You can't understand everything about these beings from that viewpoint. But you can get a good start. And it meets you where you were. You know, if you've been reading for a while, hopefully you've begun to, you know, be a little bit past where you were when all you had is the Bible or something, you know, for a story like this. Okay, but, you know, so, see, even in the midst of, you know, this first act, you know, inspection and recognition, you know, it all sounds, you know, like a little puppet show. But... You know, in the midst of that, you know, they're never doing a disservice to the truth, even if they're telling it really for a very introductory reader. The words are chosen so that they're true in general. Right, and you can grow into it. You can grow beyond just thinking of it anthropomorphically. As they're saying, think of it like a mother, father. It's like, no, literally, understand it. You know, that way. Okay, here, hold on a second.
Thought a lot about this father mother business, and it's probably a much higher concept than mother. It's probably that portion, that co-creative portion, but they didn't have a word to say it to our simple minds.
Well, I mean, and that's why I've tried to, I mean, there's two basic ways you can understand what you mean by father mother. On the one hand, the distinction between father and mother is the distinction between existential and experiential. So that's another way they would think about it. You know, experiential deity is tacked on to existential deity. You know, and in the case of the Father, it's self-experiential deity. So you don't really call it mother, you call it Father again. Father tacked on to Father. Self-experiential tacked on to existential. But in the case of the Son, it is definitively experiential tacked on to existential. Okay, so that's one way. The other way, you know, about what father and mother mean in a higher sense is father is God as transcendence. Mother is God as immanence. God that remains in. God, you know, the within facet of God, aspect of God. Whereas the father is the facet of God that's without, that reaches from outside and engages. It's an injection into place. You know, an intervention into a stream of affairs. That's a father-like action. You know, so, I mean, if you just, you know, always remember father, mother being attached to those other two pairs of words, that's always going to keep you going in the proper direction of understanding and not get you going backward into some simplistic anthropomorphic, you know, sort of notion. Existential, experiential, transcendental, yeah, or transcendent, immanent. I'd say it that way.
What's, well, there's a third, initiator. And...
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, but that isn't the single pair. Well, the father is the initiator. The mother is, you know, is a womb, focalizer,
upholder.
Very good. Yeah.
So there's just no simple.
Right. So that's what I'm saying. Just think of it. Yeah. Because the mother has a fundamental threefold nature. You know. Mother deity is not a singular fact. It's a consequence of a threefold association. You know, and so there's three words. You know, when you think about it that way, and you think about it functionally. That's why I was, you know, just think about it, you know, not so much functionally, but just, you know, in a way that has that same twofold, the two words my father and mother do. Okay.
The infinite spirit needs the eternal son in order to be upheld, to be able to go out and...
Right, I mean, I alluded to that, we touched on a very similar statement to this in the previous paper last week. Here's again, I mean, you know, very more... more to the point of why this is there for you in a way that goes way beyond telling an individuality viewpoint story about the origin of the three absolute persons. They're reminding you here, in the midst of telling the story like this, or he, the author, is reminding you, that it doesn't matter if you're talking about an infinite absolute being. It still, without the slightest qualification, only is as it is because of total, wholehearted choice. There's nothing automatic about the way the three work together. The third person has to consecrate his will perfectly to the plan at hand, to the setup at hand. I mean, there, you know, there's nothing automatic about when you're talking about will. It's free will from the highest level all the way down. So everything, you know, the perfect acting of a creator son is because of perfect choice. None of it is automatic. Every single thing that's done perfectly is done because it's chosen that way. So again, that goes all the way to the highest source. So what's in front of you? This is what you should be working on. Working towards a state where every single thing about you, you know, that's real and really you, is there and is the way it is because of perfect choice every single second of eternity. Over and over again, every second, perfect choice. Without the slightest deviation. You know, that's what it means to be finitely perfect when you get to paradise. You're in that state relative to the finite. There's not the slightest flicker in the perfection of your consecration. And it's like, wow, that's a tall order. Yeah, that's why it's a long climb to that state. We all have a lot of work ahead of us to be able to be perfect, even as they are perfect like this.
The infinite spirit, I can't really envision it as a person.
Well, I mean, that's why, I mean, if you, you know, the more definitive person were, you know, designation is conjoint actor or God of action, like the, you know, section, you know. I mean, you have the thought and the word that come together in a focus point that acts, you know. So, you know, they'll talk about that a little bit, how you can picture what it looks, you know, what you see when you look at that third person as a person. You know, what kind of a phenomenon do you see? They're about to talk about that as we get forward here. Okay. Father, mother, son. All right.
Inherent in the nature of this transaction and in mutual recognition of the personality independence of each and the executive union of all three, the cycle of eternity is established. The Paradise Trinity is existent. The stage of universal space is set for the manifold and never-ending panorama of the creative unfolding of the purpose of the Universal Father through the personality of the Eternal Son and by the execution of the God of Action, the executive agency for the reality performances of the Father-Son-Creator partnership.
Okay, now, okay, and then here we are, we're telling this individuality viewpoint story. And so once you have three persons from the individuality viewpoint, you have the relationship between the three, the Trinity relationship between the three that literally gives rise to the super additive consequence, a fourth fact, the Paradise Trinity. So they brought that in. Let me help you understand why this occurs right here. Once you finally have the three, so that you can say this, now we can think about how the story is told as you've heard it. Okay, Genesis 1, First chapter of Genesis, verse 1 and verse 2. Okay, so, you know, remember, in that story in Genesis, when it says God, when you read your, you know, and in the Bible, and you see God in those first two verses, what's the actual Hebrew word that's being translated, you know, as God? It's Elohim. Okay, and we know what Elohim actually is a designation of. The persons, the three persons of the Paradise Trinity. So, let me, you know, properly translate Elohim. And, you know, and let me give you Chris's version of verse 1 and verse 2 of Genesis chapter 1. So in the beginning, the persons of the Paradise Trinity created the heavens and the earth. Okay. Verse 1, see, that's this paragraph we just read. In the beginning, the persons of the Paradise Trinity created the heavens and the earth. Into verse 2. And the earth was formless and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of the Trinity moved upon the waters. Verse 2. Or, as it's rewritten in the first sentence of the next paragraph, and the God of action functioned, and the dead vaults of space were astir. Verse 2. This is verse 1 and verse 2, Genesis, retold. So we could take it the next notch. Let's really rework, as the revelators would, those two verses. So, in the beginning, the persons of the Paradise Trinity chose to create the universe of universes. The God of action functioned, and the dead vaults of space were astir. That's the new beginning of the Bible, as revealed to us. And it's perfectly precise. The Spirit is there in the original. You just need a little bit, you know, more precise expression of the cosmology. The heavens and the earth, it's okay, the Spirit is there. All the worlds, the earth, you know, that which is above the world, the heavens. Okay, yeah, it's there. But, you know, in the beginning, the Paradise Trinity created, you know, chose to create. You know, even make that one additional thing. Like I said, it's all by choice. In the beginning, the persons of the Paradise Trinity chose to create the heavens, or the universe of universes. It's hard to not say the other one. Chose to create the universe of universes. You know, and then period. Skip the ands like they have in Genesis. And just say, the God of action functioned, and the dead vaults of space were astir.
Is there a relation in love in the way...
You're about to get there. You know, that's coming. Just let that happen. But more, before we get to, you know, that very easy to understand thing that they're about to explain, you remember, in a more basic sense, you know, when you're talking about the triunities, the basic thing with those triunities is that you have all these different threefold combinations. But if they're a triunity of action, the Spirit has to be in there one way or another, because there is no action except through the God of action. You know, like I was saying, I mean, you know, the easiest one to think about is, I have the Father here and the Son here, and you know, just think of it like these two converging beams of creative energy that come together and leave as one beam of energy. Yeah. The God of action is the spear point of all action. All action goes through that focus point. It's through and from the third source and center that all action is expressed. Yeah. So, I mean, that's always in play. You know, so, you know, what the story that immediately is told in that mode is love, mercy, you know, thought, word, love, you know, what happens when the two come together? You know, we'll see that as we read forward here. Okay, so, you know, you can go ahead and start there. But just, you know, I wanted to really take it a little aside there so that you, I mean, you know, it, if you are familiar at all with the Bible, as you're reading this story told like he's telling it, you should immediately, it's like, wait a minute, I've heard a story that kind of sounds like that. It has kind of the same quality of you know, of the way the words, you know, flow. Yeah, he's very purposely constructing his words so that it reminds you of the way humans have told this story. Yeah. And that allows you to put the full measure of truth into the story, change the words a little bit.
The God of action functions, and the dead vaults of space are astir. 1 billion perfect spheres flash into existence. Prior to this hypothetical eternity moment, the space energies inherent in paradise are existent and potentially operative, but they have no actuality of being. Neither can physical gravity be measured except by the reaction of material realities to its incessant pull. There is no material universe at this assumed eternally distant moment, but the very instant that 1 billion worlds materialize, there is in evidence gravity sufficient and adequate to hold them in the everlasting grasp of paradise. There now flashes through the creation of the gods the second form of energy. And this outflowing spirit is instantly grasped by the spiritual gravity of the eternal sun. Thus, the twofold gravity-embraced universe is touched with the energy of infinity and immersed in the spirit of divinity. In this way is the soil of life prepared for the consciousness of mind made manifest in the associated intelligence circuits of the infinite spirit.
Okay, see, so there you have it. Like we say all the time, there are two substances, two basic energies, matter and spirit, you know, material energy, spiritual energy, like you're saying. You know, it's the second form of energy. So, you know, they're just painting the picture. You put out the material energy, you know, and of course what you're really doing is drawing that up, and then spirit energy comes down to engage that. And so now you have this relationship between the two energies, material energy and spiritual energy. And so you have mind between them, like they're saying there. That whole bit about the, you know, in this way is the soil of life prepared for the consciousness of mind made manifest in the associated intelligence circuits of the infinite spirit. So notice how fundamental that thought is. That's why we bring it up so much, you know, that there's matter and spirit and the associative fact between them. It's one of the very first things that they bring out, and they do it very definitively. You know, just literally picturing rolling out the matter and then rolling out the spirit, and then you've got the relationship between the two.
It says here that the second form of energy in this outflowing spirit is instantly grasped by the spiritual gravity of the eternal sun. Mm-hmm. Well, it's not coming from the eternal sun, is what they're saying.
Right, well, where does it come from?
Deity absolute.
Right.
Yeah, well, that's right. What I was picturing. I mean,
you roll the potential out as an actual. Out of the deity absolute reservoir comes spirit. Out of the unqualified absolute reservoir comes matter. And then where does the mind energy come from? What reservoir does it roll out of?
Universal.
Right. Potential mind becomes actual mind.
But these separate beings or entities grab.
Right, you have Right, because you have three reservoirs of those potentials for those three substances, and then you have three absolute anchors for those three energies.
When a potential becomes actualized, it falls within the gravity grasp of...
Right, it doesn't matter where it is or what level it's at. The absolute grabs it all. For matter, you have the absolute of matter, otherwise known as... No. The Isle of Paradise. What's the absolute of mind? The absolute mind, otherwise known as the infinite spirit. Okay? That's the absolute anchor point of spirit. The absolute spirit, otherwise known as the eternal sun. Okay? You know, each of them has an absolute anchor point. Three absolute actuals, three absolute potentials.
I just wanted to share one more thing on love. Is found on understanding, nurtured by unselfish service, and perfected in wisdom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then, yeah, and I know we're getting there.
Am I going too fast?
No. But just notice that they know that's a very important thing about love. You know, and so they're going to explain that. You'll see it's one of the first things that they describe. But just notice they don't describe it first, because they want to make sure that you don't start immediately thinking about and talking about love and mercy and stuff without first having a literal foundation for these thoughts. Not only a literal foundation, but a literal concept, period. Spirit is a literal substance. You know, if love is going to exist, if it's not just something that we imagine, if it actually exists, it has to be a quality of some substance. It has to be the property of something. Nothing exists that isn't literal. If goodness exists, it's a property of a substance. What is it? What is that substance? How do I understand that? If thought exists, then thoughts are literal. They're a form, a shape of some literal something. What is it? If it's not a literal something, then it doesn't exist. You know, there is no such thing as, you know, the actual abstract. Okay? You know, you abstract in your mind, but in order to create abstract thoughts in your mind, you have to literally make shapes in mindal energy. You know, a figment of your imagination is still a shape in mindal energy. Nothing exists that isn't literal. No.
There's two influences. One is spirit with spirit matter, and one is with mind. And that's how they connect with us, right?
Well, I mean, yeah.
More than just an influence. I mean, they're caressing.
But they're just saying, you know, right at the very beginning, you know, you're making Havona so that you can have matter, the pattern for matter and spirit and the mind that connects them. Everything else results from that pattern. If Havona wasn't made like that, then we wouldn't have this chart. There wouldn't be anything like that out here. Everything starts with the pattern universe. If there's matter, mind, and spirit out here, then it has to be back at the pattern. All right. Oh, you got another thing?
Very different concept than the instant that one... billion worlds blew up, or, you know.
Oh, yeah, the Big Bang, yeah. Right. Plus, the Big Bang is a magical thought.
Right.
Yeah. But now, notice, this is only Havona.
Right.
There's no outer space levels, there's no super universe right. level, there's none of that. You know, time has not begun yet.
It just materialized.
But it eternalized.
See?
It didn't have, it didn't really eventuate even. It eternalized.
It didn't blow up.
Yeah. It didn't come out of nothing.
It says back in eternity, and then you just said eternalize. Does a person think of that?
You got the last, paragraphs of both of these sections. Okay? Just saying, okay, you start thinking out of it in a time sequence. But once you understand it as a causal sequence by first thinking about it temporally, just let go of the time, but hold on to the logical sequence. It's still logical, even though it doesn't literally tick out in seconds. It's the universe is inherently logical. Even though literally at time t equals is 2, you're thinking of time t equals 1, you have the Father, time t equals 2, you have the Son, time t equals 3, you have the Spirit, even though it literally didn't happen at times 1, 2, 3 like that, it still has that causal sequence. The initiator gives rise to the initiated, to that which is initiated. There she is. You asked about the infinity. Okay, what's the when you're thinking from the in the total deity viewpoint, you start with, in order to have a starting point for the total deity viewpoint, you have to begin with causality. That's the core of the whole. You can't think about anything if it isn't rooted in a causal concept. And so you have that which acts, that which reacts, and that which results. The infinite one, the infinitude, and the infinity. I mean, you start with those three elements, and then everything else is built upon those three elements. When you're going through total deity, every facet of deity was an expression of those three elements. That which acts, that which reacts, and that which results. Because the universe is inherently causal. Everything starts with the manifestation of causality. So that's why when you tell a temporal story, you're not doing disservice to the truth. It didn't factually happen that way, but it truthfully happened that way. It has that causality. Remember how he said that? In thus reciting the order of the origin of the deities, I do so merely to enable you to think of their relationship, their causal relationship. Okay. All right, let's keep going here.
Upon these seeds of potential existence, diffused throughout the central creation of the gods, the Father acts, and creature personality appears. Then does the presence of the paradise deities fill all organized space and begin effectively to draw all things and beings paradiseward.
Okay, so see, when they're telling it in this sequence, the first thing they do is they get the threefold actuality out there. They roll out the matter, they roll out the spirit, and then they roll out the superadditive consequence between the two, the mind. And so now you have threefold thingness. Okay, and then they say the Father steps in. And he takes some of those things and he adds something to some of those things. He adds this, the fourth thing in the chart. He adds personality. And so those things become what? It's in the very last thing he read there. Not just things paradise birth, but things and beings. Yeah. So you have this threefold thingness, and then some of the specially organized threefold things can have personality identified with it, with that threefold system. And so it's not just a thing now, it's a being. And it's in the Father's personality circuit. Okay, so now we have the full threefold actuality with unity. We have matter, mind, spirit, and personality. And then look what immediately they complete the picture. Okay, upon these seeds of potential existence diffused throughout the central creation of the gods, the Father acts and creature personality appears, then does the presence of the paradise deities fill all organized space. The mother. That which fills the individuality of the whole, a presence. Yeah. So in that simple little story, so they have all the essential elements. there.
Well, that implies Trinity as well, does it not?
Sure. Yeah, and they had that came up, you know, a few paragraphs back. They mentioned that. See, all the key elements are there. You can put them together in as sophisticated an understanding as you're capable of. He's given you all the elements. You can just take them at face value as a simple little story where you really don't have too fancy of a concept of how it all hangs together. Or you don't have to, you know, bring any other element. Notice even life is mentioned because, of course, you know, technically we have life animation coming in here too. Not just matter, mind, spirit, personality. There's also life animation. So he mentions life. All the little elements are there. So you now, the more sophisticated you are, the more you can recognize how profound a story this is. That it's not just as simple a story as it first seems, as little kid puppet show sort of a story as it initially might seem. Yeah.
Also attributes to the paradise deities not only to fill all organized space but begin effectively to draw all things and beings paradise work.
Right, because once there's something that connects those things that are outside to the things that are inside, you know, that which, you know, fills the space between what's out, you know, outside and those and the things and beings that are inside, something can reach through that continuity and draw through that continuity. Again, there can't be nothing. There is no vacuum. God can't create nothing. You know, if you envision the universe as God, you know, even if he's like outside of some bubble, and then lots of little creatures are inside the bubble, and that's all there is, you know, it's just void around all the creatures inside that bubble. That's illogical, because you're thinking that somehow God created the nothingness in between them, that he created void. That's illogical. You can't create nothing. You create something. There has to be a something everywhere. And that, and philosophically, we used to understand that. That's why we never had the notion of the vacuum, because we knew that was philosophically illogical. You couldn't have a science with the notion of the vacuum. That was illogical. There had to be a plenum. There had to be something that filled all of the space between the lumps that you could feel. You know, like this couch or me, you know, there had to be, you know, or all the little atoms in the air. There has to be something between all the little lumps. It can't be empty. That's illogical, because then God would have created nothing, and you don't create nothing. So, you know, and so the notion was, well, it's got to be filled with something. You know, we always have known that. Let's actually try to turn that philosophy into a science and try to give some specific literal definition to the plenum. Let's call it the ether. So we've gone from philosophy to physics when we go from plenum to ether. But of course you had a very billiard ball notion of reality. And so this factualization of the plenum that you imagined, the ether, you thought to be a static fluid, very rarefied, very thin fluid, so thin that you really couldn't feel it. And it was static. So that was what it must be, because in the beginning there was stasis. You know, they didn't have a fundamental notion that it has to be fundamentally dynamic. They thought everything starts at zero, at stasis. So they hypothesized that plenum, you know, is what they thought the only possible plenum there could be, and then tested it, and it didn't agree with observation. So then they said, well, I guess logic is worthless. I mean, we've just proven that logic doesn't exist. It's like, no, you've just proven that you picked the wrong initial assumption. You know there has to be something in between. You assumed that it was static. That was obviously a false assumption. It's not that there's nothing in between. That's illogical. So in other words, what's in between is not static, it's dynamic. Oh my goodness, well that changes everything. If the foundation of everything is a motion, then there really aren't any static things. That's an illusion of our ignorance. Everything must be a motion. See, it just totally transforms the whole picture.
What's plenum?
Plenum is just a word that means that ubiquitous something. Fills everything. You know, you talk about plenary sessions, that's when, you know, okay, and stuff like that. You use it in the same way. But, you know, the plenum is just the ubiquitous, pervade, you know, when you talk about pervaded space, okay, that's the plenum. That space has to be filled with something.
On these seeds of potential existence diffuse throughout the central creation of the gods. So that's just when it's in the central creation.
Well, just think about it in general.
Out there, and then it goes out.
Like I said, the seeds, these, you know, there's two types of things.
Yeah.
Things that are just rocks and things that are seeds. Specially constructed things that you can engage with life animation and personality and make a being. Okay, that's, you know, they're just using that word. Is that, you know, again, don't, it's like, oh, they literally mean, do they mean like poppy seeds? You know, I mean, you know they're not, you know, you're not supposed to take it. You know, that's Nathaniel.
But diffused. Right.
The spirit of the notion, think of how they're telling the story. Oh, it's a seed for something. It's something that can grow. Rocks don't grow. So there's things that don't grow and things that can grow.
Crystals grow.
Yeah. But we use that word. You know, that's really an inappropriate use of the word grow, isn't it? See, that's the kind of thing, see, that you're supposed to go back and say, oh, we need to be a little bit more precise in the way we use language. You know, that's like saying, you know, when my leg goes, you know, from, you know, 2 feet long to 3 feet long, my leg grew. You know, that's why we talk about that. Well, not technically. That is, you know, you aren't watching perfecting spirit there. You're watching increasing number of molecules. Okay. So, see, we use the language, you know, in a very fuzzy way. And when the revelators use the word grow, they don't mean grow like your leg growing longer. They mean perfecting spirit. You know, and they also don't mean like crystals, quote unquote, growing. However you want to use it, like accrete increasing numbers of molecules in a pattern. You know, yeah, they don't grow. Right. So let's go on here.
The infinite spirit eternalizes concurrently with the birth of the Havona worlds. This central universe being created by him and with him and in him in obedience to the combined concepts of the united wills of the Father and the Son. The third person deitizes by this very act of conjoint creation, and he thus forever becomes the conjoint creator.
What's conjoint mean again?
The two together. You know, the two together. Father, Son. You know, like they said, the reality performances of the Father-Son creator partnership, you know, where Father and Son are stuck together by a hyphen. That's conjoint. you've joined them together. Okay, you know, so you have, remember, what are the names here? We have universal creator, co-creator, conjoint creator. And when you're thinking about creating, like creating Havona, that's the name for the three persons. First person is the universal creator, the second person is the co-creator, the third person is the conjoint creator.
Is that super additive?
Yeah. Yeah, the super additive consequence of the relationship between the universal creator and the co-creator is the conjoint creator. Yeah. So notice now, so in the previous paragraph, they got to the point where they actually said presence, and they used that word presence, and we know we're thinking of some sort of, you know, ubiquitous presence. And look at how they say this, okay. The infinite spirit eternalizes concurrently with the birth of the Havona worlds, this central universe being created by him. Okay, so that's the god of action. That's the spear point thing. You have this whole desire, you know, for the universal creator and the co-creator to create, and they do it conjointly through the god of action. So it's by him that it's created. And of course, it's the three together, so it's with him that it's created, and in him. It's created in him. Yeah. We have both the eternal mother son and the infinite mother spirit. And remember, that mother type deity, even though we're not going to go into great detail about the difference between the two, the easy way to appreciate the difference or think about the difference is that think of it in genetic terms, like it's a particular gene, it's a particular trait. And in the case of the infinite mother spirit, it's a dominant trait. And in the case of the eternal mother son, it's a recessive trait. They both have it, but one really expresses it quite definitively. It's out front rather than behind. The infinite mother spirit, that mother fact, that presence fact, is very out front, which makes, again, sense. If this is the spear point phenomenon, that's where the motherness is out front. The motherness is recessive, and in the back is where the eternal son is behind this God of action. Okay, so, even though there is some truth to saying that Havona is in the eternal mother son as well, they don't say that, because the first thing to understand most definitively, first and foremost, it's in the infinite mother spirit. You have a presence, and Havona is in her presence, the presence of the infinite mother spirit. She is the womb in which those seeds germinate. From the central universe. It's called a universe. If it's a universe, there's a mother. Fundamentally, when you're talking about the central universe, this is the motherness of the eternal mother, son, and the infinite mother spirit. And like we're just saying, first think of it kind of more directly as, as the infinite mother spirit's domain. It's a very complex domain. We're ignoring the details right now, but just in that basic sense of why it's called the universe and not, a sector or whatever. It's a mother place, so it's called a universe. One turning. It's one turning. There is an individuality of the whole. One turning. So just notice it's right there. If you don't have the mother concept, what on earth does it mean in him? It's actually in her, of course. But they haven't gotten to that point. We haven't used the term infinite mother spirit yet. They haven't built up to that directly. But we know where this is going. And it's already here being foreshadowed.
So the third person is the mother of Havona.
Conjointly with the eternal mother son. Let me just say that right now. What's the difference when you think about the local universe? Okay, there's one turning, there's a mother there. Okay, in the case of the local universe, she is both spirit and mind presence in this one turning. When you go all the way up to the absolute level, things get a little bit trickier. They aren't so simple like that. But it's just, in this case, you can start to understand it. It's just a slight variation on the same theme. You have the absolute mind and the absolute spirit. You have two separate presences in that one turning. In the central universe, the spirit and the mind are tied back to two different individuals, one conjoined presence. In the case of the spirit presence and the mind presence in the local universe, it goes back to one individual.
The
creative mother spirit. Well, that's not just it. It's not just that. It has to do with the fact that there's a lot of complexity at the absolute level, and we don't even want to begin to try to explain that. That's graduate level seminar stuff. Okay, but just that's the only real difference. So in terms of effect, you have this spirit presence and this mind presence, and it, you know, if you don't know that it goes back to two individuals, I mean, you have the same basic. You have this one turning with a spirit ubiquity and a mind ubiquity. You know, in the case of the local universe, we call the spirit ubiquity the Holy Spirit, you know, or the spirit substrate that you pour the spirit of truth out on. If you want to be a little bit more precise, you know, you pour the Holy Spirit and the spirit of truth out on that spirit substrate. Okay, that's that spirit presence. And then there's the mind presence, like in our case, it's adjutant mind. But, you know, it's the whole spectrum, Rancha mind and everything, you know, the whole mind presence is ubiquitous in the local universe. You have this dual presence, twofold presence. Okay, it's one turning. It's got the matter and the mind and the spirit. It's all there in one turning. So I guess, we get so sidetracked, I have to always remind myself if there was anything else important that needed to be said. No, I think we're fine. Yeah, let's go to the next one here.
The third person deitizes.
That's right. I was going to comment on that. Yeah, thank you. Remember, there, you know, it said lowercase d. Notice it's a lowercase d. We talked about that a lot when we were talking in the Supreme Papers, when they use capital D and small d deity, depending on whether it was the unity viewpoint or the individuality viewpoint. See, here, it's very much an individuality viewpoint story. So they literally word it that way. You're imagining that you, up out of the reservoirs of potential, you actualize the third person. You know, he has an energy nature that came up out of the unqualified absolute. He has a spirit nature that came up out of the deity absolute. He has a mindal nature that came up out of the universal absolute. The three came up together, deitized. You know, it's an upward picture, you know, in the way they're telling the story. See, so they're very careful. I mean, they're very careful. I mean, because they're telling a bottom-up story, they word it that way, the lowercase d. They're very careful about that.
These are the grand and awful times of the creative expansion of the Father and the Son by and in the action of their conjoined associate and exclusive executive, the third source and center. There exists no record of these stirring times. We have only the meager disclosures of the infinite spirit to substantiate these mighty transactions, and he merely verifies the fact that the central universe and all that pertains thereto eternalized simultaneously with his attainment of personality and conscious existence.
Okay. Now, I mean, everything is pretty straightforward, again, in the way he's telling this basic little bottom-up story. But, you know, I heard a chuckle over here when we read, these are the grand and awful times. You know, we need to make sure we re-understand what the word awful, you know, technically means. All right. So, you know, remember how on the levels of meaning, we have anguish and dread on the first level of meaning, and then on the second level of meaning, you have awe and reverence. There's two words on the two levels, because you have a spectrum of the three, first three and the second three adjutants on those two levels. Individuality on one end, unity on the, you know, likeness on the other end. Individuality, likeness to unity, likeness. Awe is an individuality likeness word. Okay, in what sense? Let's take a simple example. Let's talk about, you know, God the Supreme. Okay, so part of what goes in to make the Supreme is the Almighty. The Almighty is the summation of the total finite. So just imagine that. Imagine taking the total finite, past, present, and future, the total finite, and having an expression that's the sum of every individuation and individuality in that total finite. Imagine how great a summation that is. How huge a summation that is. You stand in awe of the greatness of that total individuality. Okay? You stand in awe of God the Supreme as God the Almighty. You worship God the Supreme as God the Mother. You stand in awe of God the Supreme as God the Almighty. You worship God the Supreme as God the Mother. When you're reading paper 43 about the consolation level, and they tell you about going, you know, up into the middle of the gardens, you know, the hemisphere that's all garden on Edentia, and the Most High lead you in worship, who do they lead you in worship of? God the Supreme as God the Mother. Okay? Because your entire local universe career, you know, which you're right in the middle of, is about the Mother. The Mother influence dominates, you know, the growth of your soul throughout the entire local universe career. So the acknowledgement of that's what it's all about, when you're being led in worship, you're not worshiping God, led in worship of God the Father. You're being led in worship of God the Mother. God the Supreme as God the Mother. You don't worship God the Supreme as God the Almighty. You stand in awe of God the Supreme as God the Almighty. Like the biggest volcano god you've ever imagined. Okay? But you worship God the Supreme as God the Mother. You know? And how perfectly synchronized is this whole picture? Where are you doing this? In the most magnificent gardens that you could ever imagine. You're doing it in the midst of magnificent nature. When we anthropomorphize nature, do we call it Father Nature? No. We call it Mother Nature. Right. Why do we do that? You know, because there's a truth in that. That thought is coming down. It doesn't matter how goofy and anthropomorphic and simplistic we are, our thoughts don't well up out of our toenails. They come down from above. There's an essence of truth in everything. Okay? You know, and so you've taken that simplistic anthropomorphism of nature that you call Mother Nature here, and you think, boy, I bet by the time I get up to the constellation level, I have really left such foolishness behind. No, in the most solemn of ceremonies, every week on their Sunday, you know, they have 10-day weeks, every week you gather for worship of God the Supreme as God the Mother. The real God the Mother, not the anthropomorphic God the Mother.
This was just covered on SOS if you guys want to delve into
what. Yeah, I mentioned that when we read that and went through paper 43 and, yeah, Symmetry of Soul. Okay.
Well, when they're calling the Infinite Spirit a He, isn't that to a point?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, technically, if you're just literally saying the Infinite Spirit, that's a He. I mean, of course, it's, you got to get even more technical. The He is actually the conjoint actor, and the It is the Infinite Spirit. But, you know, let's not get too technical. you know, that's an existential fact. That's a God is transcendence fact. That's a He. But, you know, like I said, we're building up, and they're giving you initial hints here. We're building up to a point when they're going to use the expression Infinite Mother Spirit. You know, and they're going to talk about how the Infinite Spirit became the Infinite Mother Spirit when He shared in the Eternal Son's experiences in Havona and acquired experiential deity. And Spirit, the Spirit became the Mother hyphen Spirit type deity. Yep.
If you pray through the Son, is it because of the Mother part of the Son? You know, that's why you have to go through Him and
how it works. Right. Yeah, that's literally because in order to get to the Father, it's got to cross all of the distance between where you are and where the Father is. And, you know, there has to be some substrate that you modulate this prayer on so that it can travel across. You know, the Spirit presence of the Eternal Mother Son is that substrate upon which a prayer moves and gets to paradise. You know?
Literal stuff.
Right. It's literal.
It's truly only through the Son.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, of course, when it actually gets to paradise, you know, the Father is at the core and he's completely enveloped in the Son. So in order for it to get to the Son, it's got to literally go through the personal presence of the eternal Son, penetrate through him to get to the personal presence of the universal Father inside.
I'm thinking of Jerusalem, where they have the world of the Father, or the Father's worlds.
Yeah.
And that's where the finaliters are, and that's where the rebellion.
Father's salvaged children. Let's not go into the details, but I'll just give you a little teaser. Okay, you've got three.
I'm seeing something.
Okay, right. You've got three levels in the local universe. Bottom up: individuality, associativity, unity. Mm-hmm. Father, Mother, Spirit, Son. Okay, when you're in the middle, you're worshiping God the Mother. Mm-hmm. When you're down there at the bottom,
who's
the deity of the individuality of the parts? Who's the initiator of individuals? The Father. Who are you worshiping down at the individuality level? The Father. Okay.
We're at the level of worshiping the Father, right?
Well, right now you're working on becoming a completed individual. That's why when all is said and done, the Father idea is still the highest human concept of God. I mean, you've got to get you leave the local system as a completed Marantia individual. You've fully manifested what the Father initiated. He initiated an individual, and it took that much work to fully express that individuality. Now you're finally an individual, so you can go to the next level where you can associate individuals. You can't associate individuals if you're not individuals yet. So it starts with individuality. Yeah, okay. Let's see. Now where were we? I've lost my place again. Yeah, that's right. We did the awful times. That's right. Okay. Right. So, I mean, awe, you know, it's gotten just really, you know, twisted. I mean, awe is a religious word. It is just that. I mean, it's a religious word. I mean, if you say, we've turned it into something that is, you know, I mean, it's on the same level as the word reverence.
It's awful what we've done to that.
It's awful what we've done to awe. Yes, it is. Yeah. All right.
In brief, the infinite spirit testifies that since he is eternal, so also is the central universe eternal. And this is the traditional starting point of the history of the universe of universes. Absolutely nothing is known, and no records are in existence regarding any event or transaction prior to this stupendous eruption of creative energy and administrative wisdom that crystallized the vast universe which exists and so exquisitely functions the center of all things. Beyond this event lie the unsearchable transactions of eternity and the depths of infinity, absolute mystery.
So, and then big paragraph break. So that's kind of that's the end of the story that you can tell with just that basic individuality viewpoint, and beyond there be dragons. You notice how it ends just the way the old maps did. Okay? Now, what does he say?
And we thus portray the sequential origin of the third source and center as an interpretive condescension to the time-bound and space-conditioned mind of mortal creatures.
I mean, everyone knows what condescension means. It means he brought it down to us.
Condescending.
He brought it down to us. Bringing it down to meet us where we are.
To our meager level.
The mind of man must have a starting point for the visualization of universe history. And I have been directed to provide this technique of approach to the historic concept of eternity. In the material mind, consistency demands a first cause. Therefore, do we postulate the universal Father as the first source and the absolute center of all creation, at the same time instructing all creature minds that the Son and the Spirit are co-eternal with the Father in all phases of universe history and in all realms of creative activity. And we do this without any sense of being disregardful of the reality and eternity of the Isle of Paradise and the unqualified, universal, and deity absolutes.
Okay, so that's a very important sentence in a paragraph in the whole book. It's directly stating what you've heard me say so many times. Like, well, aren't you just making that up, Chris? No, here it is. It's stated directly. So what in this paragraph you have what? You have the seven absolutes of infinity. You know, with the absolute of absolutes as the universal father. Therefore do we postulate. Okay? They're reminding you that, you know, when you read the book, like I've said so many times, and you see them, it's like, well, let's attempt to understand this by starting with the seven absolutes of infinity. That's what he's saying here. You know, that's going to be their starting postulate. There's the starting way that they're going to see if they can get you to understand things. It's like, they're individuals. Let's start them with an individuality viewpoint. Let's expand it a little bit so that it isn't just some monotheistic bearded guy. Let's have seven absolutes of infinity. And that's our that's the initial postulate. Notice it's the word is postulate. That's one way of looking at it, but it's not the whole story. That's what this is. You can't turn the seven absolutes of infinity, you know, into the only way to think about everything. The book does not say that, like right here. Does this sound like, and don't you dare even attempt to try to understand anything any other way than, I mean, he just said that it's an interpretive condescension, okay?
It's a starting point.
To the material mind.
More or less distortion.
Okay, well, is that, well, okay, I guess if that's all you ever want to be is a material animal origin mind, you're going to deny the existence of anything else within you, no Holy Spirit, no Spirit of Truth, no thought of Jester, no nothing. You know, you're just going to be an animal origin blob of matter. It can only think like simplistic puppet show time sequences. You know, and anyone who says there's anything else is an abomination. Okay, that's not what the book says. Okay, it says this is the baby starting point. Okay? And, but it's a powerful starting point. It's much more than anything you've ever had.
Nobody else has conceived this.
Right, right.
Have they?
But once you've transcended everything that's gone before you by embracing the seven absolutes infinity, full-blown individuality viewpoint, now go beyond that. Or more precisely, not really go beyond it. What do? You add the other half of the story to it. Because it's not really something that needs to be left behind. It's something that needs to be, it's only half the story. It only tells the part that can be described with words like lowercase d deitizes. It can only tell a bottom-up story. What about the parts of the universe that are not understandable from the bottom-up? What about the parts of the universe that can only be understood from the top down? You can't understand those with the seven absolutes of infinity. It's not possible. So, yeah. And it's like, well, how do you know that they start to suggest that you add the other half of the story? The very first paper, the Supreme Papers, it says, you know that seven absolutes of infinity starting point that we told you about on page 92? Well, that's not going to quite work here. Let's rearrange it a little bit, and let's start with three things instead of seven things. Let's have the original, the actual, and the potential. And that was we've talked about that. It was the baby steps of trying to evolve what they're sure is probably kind of become a fixation now on the seven absolutes infinity by the time you get all the way up to the first Supreme paper. You know, this is paper page 92. It's a lot of pages. Okay, so they know that this is really, really ingrained in you by the time you get there. So they try to give you a way of evolving this into this. Rather than trying to force you to just suddenly jump. So they say, take the three absolute potentials and merge them into one thought, and the three absolute actuals and merge them into one thought, and then tweak the notion of the Father and call it the original. Okay. Yeah, Jason?
With the result, the act, the react, and the result,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
is the trust and obey, and then after trusting and obey, then there's that super additive, isn't there?
I mean, the spirit is a direct expression of that which results. Okay, that's one way to understand it. And I apologize for, I've been kind of tabling your thoughts here because it's we're not going to get to it tonight now because it's gotten kind of extended. But, see the nature of the infinite spirit, that's when they start to really talk about what you were suggesting. So, we'll pick that up next time in the next section. But, where we get to understanding, it's like, well, we had love for the thought God, and we had mercy for the word God, how do we understand the third source and center? So we'll have to get to that next time. But let's finish what they have here. So just that second to last paragraph there is directly pointing out, trying to get you to see that what they're going to use now for pages and pages and pages is just an initial perspective. They try their best to if you were paying attention, Claire, up here in these first papers, you wouldn't be so locked in when you got to the Supreme Papers that you couldn't still be taught something. You'd still have teachable mind when you got to the Supreme Papers. Yeah.
It is enough of a reach of the material mind of the children of time to conceive of the Father in eternity. We know that any child can best relate himself to reality by first mastering the relationships of the child-parent situation, and then by enlarging this concept to embrace the family as a whole. Subsequently, the growing mind of the child will be able to adjust to the concept of family, relations, to relationships of the community, the race, and the world, and then to those of the universe, the super-universe, even the universe of universes.
Okay, so just see how he ended that? So does he want you to stay where he's starting you? No. And he very specifically labels where he's starting you. A child. He's starting you as a child. But there needs to be a subsequently. Subsequently, the growing mind of the child. And now we really mean growing. Not like crystals growing, not like legs growing. Okay. Growing mind. Just notice how he's juxtaposed those. I mean, it's all right there, the seeds of here's how I'm starting you. Where I'm starting you is where a child starts, and then you should grow. So then if you were really sharp, even this early in the book, you'd be going, well, okay, so what's the rest of the story? If the seven absolutes infinity is how a child starts, what does a growing child or even an adult of God, how else do they think about the universe? And how else is they bring in the unity viewpoint at the same time that they, Gene, they were encouraging you to get this firm grip on the seven absolutes. Yeah, get a firm grip on the seven absolutes, but then recognize that you have two hands for a reason so that you can grab a hold of the individuality viewpoint and the unity viewpoint at the same time. You have two eyes. So that you can see the individuality viewpoint and the unity viewpoint at the same time.
And then you get to do something with it.
And you have two hands and two feet. Right. I mean, right. So, You know, I know I'm stressing this a lot, but I just, you know, the fact that these little details are all here has just been glossed over. Yeah. Okay? We need to stop glossing over them so that we have the recognition that will allow for a growing picture. The revelation is not just what immediately meets the eye. You know, it's the revelation is what can't immediately meet the eye. It's a revelation of truth, not of fact. So you have to stay, you know, notice when they're telling you, grab a hold of this, but don't absolutize it. Don't grab it with both hands. Just grab it with one hand. Because you need the other one for the other half of the story.
Well, what is it in this paragraph and the one before it that should point me to the seven absolutes of infinity?
The universal Father, the eternal Son, the infinite Spirit, the Isle of Paradise, the unqualified absolute, the universal absolute, the deity absolute. They list them all seven of them.
Yeah, but they don't name them as that, so no one would think of it as that at that point.
Well, I mean, this is page 92. If you go back on page page 5.
That's why they call it the
four. They introduced total infinite realities existential in seven phases and seven coordinate absolutes.
There's all kinds of things where they're all, you know, some mystery in some realm where they're always saying, well, you know, this is a limit of our understanding, or, well, this might be what the deities are going to do in the future, but we really don't know it. Mm-hmm. On and on and on.
Right.
It just doesn't make sense that somebody right up there doesn't just go ask him, and that they don't tell him.
Hey, what if he could, Kent, don't you?
Right. Right. I mean, Gene knows the answer. That's the answer. It's just like the secrets of supremacy. I mean, is it something that's being held back from you? No, it's something that can't be told. There is no way for even the absolute mind, take it up another notch, it's always the infinite mind, the third source and center. There's no way for even the infinite mind to construct a download to even a very high being to describe that which goes beyond Havona. Okay? Even in all of his infinity, the only thing he can give is meager. Not because he's inadequate or he's holding back, doesn't want to tell us anything. The meagerness is the ear. Is the ear that's hearing. how detailed a story can the infinite spirit tell to the eternal Son? A really, really detailed, the entire story, okay? Right. The meagerness is not on the part of the voice. It's on, you know, on the part of the mouth. It's on the part of the ear.
But what about when it comes to meager details? I mean, when say something like, you know, what the outer space levels are going to be used for. I mean, that's not infinite.
Well, I mean, the three persons don't need to actually write an essay on that. Everything that can be told has already been told. It's called the central universe. The central universe already foreshadows the whole eternity story. It's a condensation of the whole story in many ways. When you go to Havona, you don't just find something that's finite. You don't just find something that's even just absent.
Right.
Remember, it says that all those levels, you have material, morontial, spiritual, absonite, ultimate, co-absolute, absolute. You know, they talk about mind there going all the way up to the existential, experiential, i.e., the absolute upholder. Okay, the whole story is there. I mean, all you have to do is just, you know, I mean, be able to understand that story. And, you know, the higher being you are, the more you can understand of that story, and you can understand the outer space levels. But what, you know, technically is going on in the outer space levels is transcendent of even a high finite being. There's no way to tell a divine counselor what actually is going to happen in the outer space levels, because he has no frame of reference for the story. If the infinite spirit starts telling that story, the divine counselor will hear, bleh, 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 bleh. It'll make no sense. The story can't be told to a finite mind. Nothing about what's going to go on once it is all said and done with the finite is understandable. Even to people that have already kind of put their toe on the threshold, like a master son, even they don't understand what actually lies on the other side of the threshold. You know, and they're already, as a deity fact, functioning in the ultimate Trinity. And even they consciously don't understand exactly what that next stage is really all about. So
you can perceive the basic frame of those higher existences, but you can't think with them.
You can't fill it out. You can't flesh it out in any way.
At all. You got to wait until you get there.
You know, and think about how much they you know, if you know, these higher beings that go to Havona see it in its absonite geometry. I mean, just think how much that would help you to imagine what the next age might be like. If you actually have some sense of what absonite geometry is, you know, you might be able to even speculate some about what the master universe might look like geometrically. In the absonite, no, a finite, you know, I can't. I mean, I know nothing of absonite geometry. You know, it's utterly clueless, you know. There's no way I can know. Now,
he doesn't know.
I know that I will begin to get a little insight into that when I go, when I have full-blown Marantia mind, the insight that I have there starts to get, to have the quite high transcendent potential, called the insight of absonity. You know, right now I have material mind and Holy Spirit insight. You know, and I actually go from having just the spirit of wisdom as an adjutant to Marantia wisdom to Moda. You know, the insight that lies beyond that Marantia wisdom, you know, actually begins to be insight of absonity. I begin to start to have some insight into absonity. So I'm going to, at an early age, I'm going to start to get some inklings of this, and by the time I get to Havona, I can actually engage the absolute geometry of that domain. I'm going to start to have the ability to start to speculate quite a bit about what the super universes might look like and everything in the next age. You know, how the whole geometry is going to get rearranged so that there might be some sort of a centralness to Uversa. For instance, if I speculate that that's where the Supreme Being is going to stand, if he's going to stand on Uversa, I've got to somehow imagine that there's a geometry in which that's central. And right now, it's just part of the periphery. You know, just like I said, I mean, you know, you talk about a pilot world on a circuit of Favona. Well, you know, from a finite, you know, the finite picture they paint, you just got this string of pearls. It's just one of many in a periphery. You know, what's so special about that one? I mean, you know, it's not just because it's painted red and the other are painted green. Okay, it has to be literally geometrically somehow, you know, an apex, a center, a something. It has to somehow be special geometrically, you know, and the finite picture doesn't paint that. When you project it down into the finite, it loses its specialness of location in the geometry. Yeah. Just like, you know, if I have things, you know, in a stack like this, I project them down into the plane, you know, they seem all the same. Okay. So, yeah, I mean, all those questions are just not accessible to us right now.
Imponderable.
Right, they're just imponderable. But, you know, but they tell you, even when you've made it all the way to paradise and head back out again and have a really expanded picture, you're still going to be really fundamentally clueless about the next age. You'll just have a fancier framework, but it's still going to have nothing in it.
Right.
It's still going to be empty. You still won't be able to say, well, okay, yeah, so I might have this framework, but I still have no idea what you fill it with. What is actually going to go on? I don't understand. Okay, not even the divine counselors or anyone understands what really goes on in, you know, in any framework that they can envision. So, but you know, so I think you get the point. And then the only other thing to add to that is just remember that in the specifics of this paragraph, it's this story for a child. So make sure you don't take it too Nathaniel-like. Okay? You know, it's being told in kind of a simple way. don't limit yourself to that simplicity.
Don't run with it.
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, at the same time, there's a spirit of truth, and that's what I've been trying to, you know, expound upon here this whole time. All right. So we'll finally, you know, we'll get into the nature now then of the infinite spirit next time, and we'll get a little bit more into that whole question of, well, I need a little bit more understanding. It's like, well, how does this really relate to me? And that's what we'll get to next time. Let's take a moment here.